nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Well, it's a delight to be here and with this kind of multidisciplinary audience. I imagine I will mystify or patronize some part of the audience continuously. I will try to do neither, but I apologize to both. So I'm talking today about a particular class of proteins called ion channels, which have a hole down their middle. And through this hole, ions, sodium, potassium, chloride, and calcium chiefly, flow. And these ion channels control the motion of those ions through membranes, and they control a very large fraction of biological systems, much to the surprise of us, those of us who have worked on this subject for a long time. We had no idea when we started working on these molecules that they would turn out, in fact, to be the main controllers of biological function. That has actually only been shown in the last 5 or 6 years when our molecular biology friends, following their general burn and slash method of studying everything, found a set of proteins called the ABC proteins, worked on them for 10 years without knowing what they did, and then found out that they are all transporters and channels, and they account for 30 to 40% of all the proteins in your body. These are, of course, very important because they include the garlic receptor, without which food would be very poor, and all sorts of very specific channel proteins. Now, the important thing for us to understand is that channels are fundamentally valves. Fundamentally, they control what comes in and out of cells, and the strategy that cells use is very much the same as strategy used in transistors or the strategy that you would use in Purdue if terrorists were a problem. If you had a lot of terrorists wandering around Purdue, you wouldn't search the campus for them. It wouldn't work very well. You would throw a fence around the campus and control who comes in and out. That looks like a sort of silly analogy here, but I used it at Hebrew University in Jerusalem once, and it was quite appropriate, where in fact they have a double fence. So for the sake of those of you who are not biologists, I need to go through this list of some of the things that ion channels do. Otherwise, you're going to think I'm just an overenthusiastic proponent of what I do, which I am. But it also happens to be true that ion channels are of extraordinary importance. First of all, ion channels are directly responsible for all electrical activity of cells, period. There is only one cell type in the body that is known not to have electrical activity. Anyone know what it is? It's the red blood cells. But in fact, they do have electrical activity. Their voltage has to be clamped exactly to zero or they will not function, okay? And they actually have a special system to control it. So zero is a number two, okay? Ion channels produce all the signals of the nervous system. Everything that allows you to see me, everything that carries information in the nervous system over any distance are electrical voltages just as much as the voltages in that computer. And by the way, the particular ions and so on that carry the current are much less important than the actual voltage and charge movement itself. Ion channels coordinate contraction in skeletal muscle. That usually is a big sigh to an audience like this, because few of you realize that even an aging, obese male like myself has about 40% of my body mass as skeletal muscle. It really matters that skeletal muscle contracts when it's supposed to. Now, in the case of the heart, the role of ion channels to coordinate contraction is extraordinarily important. The heart is a perfect example of unintelligent design, which somebody should explain to our president. The heart could not be worse designed. The slightest defect in muscle contraction in the heart, and it is no longer able to pump blood. The bottom of the ventricle has to contract first to squeeze blood out. and your heart uses the muscle itself to conduct the control system. And the engineers in the audience know that the worst possible way to conduct a control signal is to run it through an energy power system. You want to have separate wires. Well, insects learned how to do that a very long time ago. Mammals and vertebrates have never learned how to do that. So the channels that we talk about today, in fact, are all cardiac channels, and any failure in them means 30 seconds left of consciousness. The exact channel I'll talk about mostly is a calcium channel or a bit, and that calcium channel is the object of calcium channel blockers. The target of calcium channel blockers, about $5 billion a year is spent on those drugs. If you could double the amount of current through that channel, you would save 400,000 lives a year in the United States. So there are very, very practical reasons to study channels. Ion channels are directly involved in secretion and absorption in all cells, kidney, intestine, liver, adrenal glands. All hormones are secreted under the control of channels. Diabetes, too, is a channel disease, et cetera, et cetera. So ion channels are involved in thousands of diseases, and 30 to 40% of all drugs act on channels directly or one step away, modify something which acts on channels. In fact, about 5 years ago, a wonderful scientist in England, Fran Ashcroft, coined the word channelopathy to describe specific genetic diseases of channels, where one could make a survey of the genome and find a defect in the genome that was, in fact, in a channel. When she wrote her book, there were five such diseases known. A year and a half ago at Biophysics, when she gave a talk on this, she didn't know how many diseases there are known. If you type channel disease or channelopathy into Google, you'll get something of the order of 10,000 separate diseases. Now, you would think that this is unimportant because each disease only has 200 or 300 people in the United States with the disease. But you multiply 10,000 by 200 and you have lots of patients. It's very, very practical. And of course, the most extraordinary example of that is cystic fibrosis, which is exactly a channel disease. Ion channels, fortunately, are proteins whose genes, that is, blueprints. Those of you who are outside of biology, a gene is a blueprint, period. It has all the characteristics of a blueprint. It's a lot easier to change a blueprint than it is a building, right? So whose genes can be manipulated by molecular genetics. That means that with a certain amount of work, which means about a postdoc for 2 weeks, you can change the charge groups, the charge groups in this protein specifically, which is something Intel and AMD doesn't know how to do, to put a charge group in a specific place. And we can ask them how much money they would pay you for a patent that allowed them to put charges, dopings, groups in exact places. But we can do that trivially, meaning a postdoc for a couple of weeks in these molecules, and we do it. And in favorable cases, we actually have X-ray structure. This is a favorable case. Every one of those atoms' location is known. So it's important for those of you who are involved with nanotechnology to understand that we can control charge distribution. Forget these fancy chemical names like acid and base. Charge distribution more accurately in a protein than in any other non-crystalline material. So the chances of being able to use these things is very, very great if we can understand them. So channels are only holes. So why can't we understand and build them? If channels are just holes and ions that we deal with here are just spheres, surely we should be able to predict how spheres go through a hole. And the question is, why can't we do that? Though, again, for those of you from the biology end, I want to remind you that this building is built with equations, that an airplane wing is calculated, and no one builds one to test it. No one builds a scale model of the building. In fact, all of the technology which makes our standard of living possible comes from just the very small part of the world that follows equations. Why can't we do something like that for just spheres going through a hole? Well, I think my own answer to that, speculation, not to be believed, my own answer to that is that we've headed in the wrong direction. For 50 years, people have used models based on gas phases. For 50 or even more years, structural biologists have guessed, have guessed the trajectories of individual atoms instead of calculating them. So I think that's why it hasn't worked. But anyway, how are we going to start? Not with my opinion. We're going to start with data, real experimental data. So one of the nice things about ion channels is that you can study them one molecule at a time. You put them in an apparatus which has a soap film. The soap film is in the middle of this box here. You connect up an amplifier. If you want, you can use ours. I think it probably is the best one on the market still. And in one of my great successes, I predicted that we would sell 300 of them 22 years ago. I was considered grossly exaggerating. Everybody else thought we would sell 100. We're now up to approximately 23,000. And they're not very useful for the Mozart or for the kind of noise, music that that most of the younger generation listens to. So they really are, they don't wear out. So there are a lot of people studying channels. So what we're able to do is to put one of these channel molecules in the lipid bilayer with an art equivalent to making a souffle in a strange kitchen at a different altitude. And then, oops, and if I can get the cursor to work, then we get current records that look like this. These are, in fact, random telegraphs. Well, that didn't work either, okay? We'll try once more, and then we'll give up. We'll do it on the computer. Yes, and that is an actual experimental signal. It's a random telegraph signal, it is exactly defined. The background noise is all instrumentation noise, and each one of those spikes represents a rectangular opening, badly resolved here, of a channel. This is a blown-up single record. The channel is closed here. There's no current going through it. It suddenly opens. The opening time is of the order of a microsecond and really can't be resolved. The duration can range from a few microseconds, well resolved, to many seconds or even minutes. There are two different sets of properties involved in channels, whether you study them physically or pharmacologically, that is putting drugs on. One is the process that controls the opening. That's the time behavior, and that's called gating. It's not called gating because we know anything about a gate, okay? So don't let the language mislead you. It's because the people who invented the word thought there was a gate there, not that there's evidence for a gate. And that behavior, the opening and closing, is responsible for 80 or 90% of biology. And every one of these 30 or 40,000 channel types that is studied has a different system for controlling the open duration and the gating. The garlic channel responds to guess what? Garlic. A voltage-sensitive channel responds to voltage. A mechanical-sensitive channel responds to mechanical stress, etc., etc. So that's a very biological variable. The height of the current is called permeation, and that's a very physical variable. That's wonderful for those of us from a physical background because it is a physical variable that can be measured with physical precision. Everybody in the world gets the same answer to a tenth or even a hundredth of a percent if you do the experiment carefully. And we'll be talking about both of that. Our goals are to understand gating and understand selectivity well enough that we can build them, manipulate them, and cure diseases that involve them. Of course, we have been an utter failure in all respects. So I normally have never talked, in fact, this is the first, second seminar in which I've ever discussed gating, because my approach has been rather pedestrian, one step at a time, trying to understand things, and I couldn't understand anything about gating. But about a year ago, we came up with what we hope is an intelligent guess about gating, and I think it's very clear that this guess is very productive of good science, even if it's wrong. Those of you just beginning in science should know that science does extremely well when people make mistakes, as long as you can tell whether you've made a mistake. if you say something that is so vague or so well designed to get grants that nobody can tell whether it's right or wrong, you may get a lot of money, but you're not going to build devices that work. So our guess here is that channels open and close because a bubble, that is a cavity, an empty space, comes and goes inside the channel. So that's a very specific hypothesis that we're making. We're making it because simulations of channels, which we did not do, many other people have done, show such emptying. The basic idea is that water holds together because it sticks together at the molecular level. And if you put in a surface, particularly a closed surface like a channel, which water will not stick to, then water pulls away from that surface and you're left with an empty space or a vapor called a bubble. Now, bubbles are fundamentally unstable blockers of conduction. They are a vapor region that blocks the flow of ions. I think it's obvious ions cannot get through a vapor very easily. They have enormously high resistance. They are inherently unstable. Because they are inherently unstable, workers who have done simulations, and there have been about 6 laboratories who have done very, very careful simulations, have not been able to get reproducible results. And being excellent scientists, they sort of therefore rejected the work to their, I shouldn't say rejected, abandoned, or didn't pursue the work, to their credit, because each graduate student and postdoc got different results. What we point out is that that is a characteristic of simulations of any threshold phenomena, let alone one with badly defined force fields and so on, which are necessarily the case in molecular dynamics. Yes?
So, like, you are talking about one atom at a time. So how big is the bubble?
About 10 atoms by 10 atoms, maybe 100 or 200 atoms.
So that's outside the channel?
No, it's in the pore of the channel. I'll show you a picture of one in a minute. It's just supposed to be an empty space. When you do a molecular dynamic simulation, you actually find that under conditions, everything moves away from there. Okay? That's actually seen in the simulation quite often.
So a channel can actually hold you like 10 by 10?
Yes, many more than that. Now, I'm sorry, the dimensions are there would be thousands of atoms in that pore normally. Okay? A mixture of ions and water and side chains of the protein. And I encourage, by the way, I should have said explicitly, please do ask questions. Okay, so does that make sense? Yeah. Our view is that each type of channel biases the formation of bubbles or the filling of bubbles a different way. The garlic receptor might have garlic that would hook on to a special part of the molecule, a small change in diameter, or a small change in the electrical potential on the wall of the channel would make or break the bubble. And we can show by our theory that any small perturbation will make or break a bubble. So we are only talking about the final step in gating being a bubble. And of course, the main point, just one sec, the main point of this hypothesis is to try to motivate people to find them and not talk about them. Yeah.
How are the atoms held together?
What's that?
You said the bubble is an empty space that consists of around 10 by 10 atoms. So how are the atoms held together?
They're held together outside of that by the forces between the atoms in the protein. The protein itself is really quite strong and has elaborate forces to hold itself together. The fact that water should retract and produce an empty space is surprising. And if you're surprised, I'm surprised. But those of you who do experiments with nanocapillaries or even microcapillaries will know how extremely easy it is to get a bubble in a capillary and how hard it is to fill it. So it turns out there's really a great deal of experimental evidence on a scale larger than proteins for such phenomena. It was actually, believe it or not, first studied by Newton. Not that I knew anything about that. And finally, we believe that the mechanism of gating is the mechanism that biases the bubble. It will be different in each of these protein types. Well, I was very surprised and amazed 2 or 3 weeks after our paper was published to see a paper in Nature by a very good friend of mine, the man who actually drew those lovely figures before, Ryman Dutzler. This is a particular channel called the ELIC channel protein. It's actually a soluble protein that looks just like a channel. And lo and behold, he experimentally observed xenon. That is, he crystallized the structure in xenon And lo and behold, it went into two things that we would have called a bubble. Being a careful Austrian working in Switzerland, he immediately wrote me an email saying, Bob, don't call it a bubble. And I wrote back saying, you're absolutely right. And I'm still, I left out a T, I'm sorry. There should be a T in there. And I apologized, but I wanted to use a vivid name so people would remember it. Okay. So this is really a cavity or an empty space with a little bit of water or something in here. He couldn't resolve in the x-ray what's here. Now, we constructed, really Roland Roth, constructed a simple, robust thermodynamic model of these bubbles. And the point of this is to take advantage of what's called density functional theory of statistical mechanics and a form of it that Roland has derived that allows you to do scaling in quite an unambiguous way. So you can write equations for the driving force for bubble gating. You can assume that the probability of opening and closing is an activation process. And if you do that, you can find a rather interesting prediction, which is that noble gases, which are known to be anesthetics and known not to bind to proteins, should have a profound effect on this kind of gating. And so that's our prediction there, which is actually known. And also, we predict that there should be a large effect of hydrostatic pressure, of altitude, for example, on anesthesia. Any of you who get into an accident while skiing will be very pleased to know that your anesthesiologist will use a very different mixture than they would in Purdue. And not because of the snow, but because of the altitude. So it's very well known and completely unexplained why there is a great sensitivity to pressure in gas anesthesia. So this is our idea. But what's important is not our idea. What's important is experimental evidence. And our idea is designed to show that bubble gating is a robust prediction of a thermodynamic model and that people should look for the bubbles. Okay? Not that we have evidence. Okay. So some bubbles have been seen. This is just published 3 or 4 weeks ago. So we will, next time along, I'll let you know what happens. Now I'm going to move on to the kind of science I'm much more comfortable with, where we think we can actually prove something, let's hope so, and do it carefully. And what I'm going to do here is follow an approach that I call physics as usual, in which one makes a hypothesis, makes predictions from it, checks it against a great deal of experimental data, and then adds more to the hypothesis. I will make no attempt to compute the properties of all atoms or something of that sort that I simply don't know how to do. So we're going to be talking about selectivity. And selectivity is the property that allows different channels to tell different ions apart. From those of you from the semiconductor world, it's as if we had holes and electrons of many different flavors, and what's different about them is their charge and their diameter, because our quasi-particles are not quasi-particles, they're particles. And in a way, we're better off than you are, because your quasi-particles don't always hold together. They don't always do everything they're supposed to do, I am told, okay? But our ions hold together. They don't disappear. So these are the channel types that we've worked on. I want to reiterate that the synthetic calcium channel and calcium channel are closely related, but the other channels have totally different genomes, very, very different properties. And so we didn't try to make these all the same, and we've been able to work reasonably well with these, as you'll see. The same approach of using dramatically reduced protein models has now been adopted by Benoit Roux, who was the father of the all-atom approach. But when he came to work on specific selectivity, he felt that he had to reduce the model, and I think he does a much better job of it than we do. Susan Rempe is doing quantum mechanics on reduced models, and again, the same approach. So the idea of using a reduced model of a protein is not controversial. Maybe wrong, okay, but it's not foolish and it's not controversial anymore. The crucial thing that is different in our approach is that we believe we have to fit large amounts of experimental data taken under many, many different conditions before we have a satisfactory model. So when most people talk about selectivity, they talk about a measurement at one voltage with one set of concentrations. we would never mention that to you. Our experiments involve tens of solutions over large ranges of concentration, and where possible, we do full current voltage curves, which is a large amount of data. Those of you who are chemists, each point in a current voltage curve corresponds to a separate Michaelis-Menten rate measurement. So there's a huge amount of data here. This is just, I tend to talk too much, so I'm going to give you the crucial pieces of evidence first, then get stuck in the explanation. But I want you to see the evidence. The crucial and best evidence comes from a former student of mine and Mark. Mark was on the Dirk's committee, but I haven't had anything to do with this work except to congratulate Dirk. These are current voltage relations from the ryanodine receptor. Notice that they are complicated. Notice what we call a misfit. That's a misfit. The error is less than a tenth of a KT. Okay, that's very, very little. And the model has 8 parameters, every one of which is picked up from a single measurement and never adjusted. Okay? And Dirk has been able to do 120 different solutions with the same model and the same fit, and I showed you the worst fits. Much more important, especially for some of the people I've talked to this morning, is this experiment. Gerhard Meissner, who did the experiments with Dirk, is a very strict old-time biochemist who doesn't believe any of this theory stuff. So he says, you keep talking about charge and voltage. Those of you who know me know I tend to talk about that. Don't believe any of it, Bob. I'm going to take all the charges out, and Dirk will never fit it. So I wanted to run away because Dirk is a student and friend of mine. I didn't want to make a fool of him. So what Gerhard did was a mutation which takes out all of the charge from 13 molar to zero. Water is 55 molar. This is not a small perturbation. This is a fantastically large perturbation. All of the forces that you might calculate, compressibility, have to be very, very different when you take out that amount of charge. To our absolute amazement, not only did he do this, he did 2 different versions of that mutation, but the current voltage curves fit, and you can characterize that yourself. There are no adjustable parameters here. So you can take all the charge out with a mutation and fit perfectly. This, by the way, implies that the structure of the protein cannot have changed.
That's my question.
Exactly. If the structure had changed to, I mean, if we changed the diameter in the model, 3 or 4%, the curve would have been out here. Okay? And this has been reproduced. I mean, Meissner is, you know, he's really tough. He did 120 experiments. Okay? I mean, 120 solutions. Each one has 5 or 10 experiments. So this is a sound result. In another set of experiments, we've been able to take a protein porin, the one I showed you there, that has nothing to do with calcium channels, and that is unselective, and put into its narrow region the 4 glutamates that our theory, which I'm about to show you, says are crucial, and when you do that, you get calcium selective channels. And we've done the mutation 2 different ways. So we can actually build calcium selective channels. So I wanted to show you the evidence first before we get into a discussion. Oh, and Zuzana Siwi can put a lot of carboxylates into a plastic hole, no protein, and you also get a calcium channel. Okay, not a perfect calcium channel, but the main properties. So now how are we going to try to understand selectivity? The basic idea we're going to start with as an assumption, which is not true for everything. We're going to say we assume this is the main crucial property and see how well we do. That's the way physical scientists do things. That's how your computers are designed. It's not the way most biologists think, but there is nothing to apologize about making a drastic approximation if you compare it with experiment. And if it's no good, you throw it away and you do the next one. That's our approach. So we're going to assume that the crucial variables in a protein are what we call crowded charge. We're going to say that what matters is the diameter of the ions, the charge on the ions, and particular parts of the protein structure, but only particular parts that we'll talk about. And it is perfectly appropriate to say that this model is ridiculous. That was the opinion of the authors who created it, Wolfgang Nahner and myself. And you can say whatever you will, but I was taught protein structure by John Edsel. who showed me the first Kendrew paper on myoglobin structure, so I do know what protein structures are. Our approach is consciously to take as little of the structure as possible and see what we can do. The reason we do this is because we are fundamentally biologists. We know that the active sites of proteins are extraordinarily unusual places. They are fantastically charged. The UMPF that I showed you has 20 molar charge. If you look in the PDB data bank of enzymes, you will find enzyme after enzyme in which the charges in the active site are of the order of 10 to 20 molar. Why do I say that? These are extraordinarily high numbers. And any good biologist knows to look at the obvious. If you see a hunk of tissue that refracts light, you assume it's a lens, not a heart. If you see a ball and socket joint, you study the properties of ball and socket joints, not the general properties of proteins or bones. If we see a fantastically concentrated salt solution, maybe we should study what concentrated salt solution should do, and then add all of the things that we can't do, like quantum mechanics and so on. Some of you can do that I can't do. Okay. So this is based on a result of modern physical chemistry that is not widely known, but is very, very well established. The fundamental property of ionic solutions is called the free energy per mole, or the activity. The role of activity in studying ionic solutions is equivalent to the role of height in studying gravitational fields or voltage in the electric field. It's the main variable. Not the only variable, but the main variable. So it has been a tremendous frustration until about 1985 or 90 that one could not predict the properties of a sodium chloride solution. One could not understand the free energy per mole of a sodium chloride solution even in 1980. This is sort of bad business, right? Why is it so important to biology? All of biology essentially occurs in salt solutions. If you get the salts wrong, the proteins don't work. There's no freedom about this. Well, it turned out that the reason people could not understand these salt solutions is that they had been paying attention to the water instead of the mathematics. Since 1920, people have been making more and more complicated models of hydration and so on, and not been able to predict the free energy per mole. Then Joel Leibowitz came along. Don't know what he said privately. Undoubtedly was in Yiddish, which I don't understand. And decided, let's actually calculate by mathematics, doing a Wiener-Hopf integration, what the properties are of a bunch of spheres. And if you read the paper, his level of chemical sophistication suggests that he didn't know that water had molecules in it. But he got the spheres right. And it turns out that when you calculate the properties of spheres right, you find out that you can account for the free energy per mole of charged spheres very well. We can talk about that later. I've had nothing to do with it, but I've been taught it by Doug Henderson, Jean-Pierre Hansen, Stuart Rice. These are famous people. And this is an established result with certain error bounds, of course. So the point is that these properties of solutions come from only the diameter and the charge of the ions and the dielectric properties of the water. So that's what we're going to include in our model. What we're going to try to explain is a binding curve. This is the binding curve which allows you, your heart to beat. So let's hope it doesn't change suddenly. If you have 100 millimolar sodium chloride around, and you slowly add calcium to this channel, you will find that if there's no calcium around, this channel is fortunately for happy. But when you get up to just 1 micromole calcium, half of the contents of this channel is calcium. So it's very, very selective. More selective, actually, than most technologically available binding proteins. Now comes our model of the protein. I better get away from you, because you should throw me. This is the most ridiculous model of a protein. Our model of a protein is a hole. And our side groups, our glutamates, are spheres. And the spheres are treated exactly as if they're mobile ions, except they're not allowed to leave this region. So it is literally true that Wolfgang Nanner and I, when we thought of this sitting at Santa Barbara, which is where we happened to have been in some sort of meeting, said, well, this is ridiculous, but we want to learn a particular theory, the mean spherical approximation, we might as well do it on something specific. We were absolutely amazed that when you calculate that, you get a calcium channel, okay, which no one had ever got before by any method, okay, just what I showed you. Now I'm going to show you a much more sophisticated calculation 27 papers later, but that main result was available right then. The calculation I'm going to show you is, in fact, a Monte Carlo simulation done by Dejo Bodo, who, with Doug Henderson, is responsible for more than three-quarters of all the Monte Carlo simulations done on bulk solutions and bulk solutions next to mercury, next to electrodes. So the code is independently checked in the physical world. Now, what we're going to do is an extremely simple calculation. We're going to treat the solution as spheres. We're going to treat the channel as simply a small region with the side chains just being spheres and a dielectric shroud. And what's different in this calculation, for any of you who have seen our earlier papers, is we finally, after many years of work, learned how to calculate the dielectric shroud. Bob, we didn't know how to do that calculation, a dielectric boundary condition, efficiently and accurately. And it turns out to be nasty. It doesn't sound like it should be, but unless you do it right, you get tremendous errors, 8 or 800% easily. So that took mostly Dirk about 3 years to learn how to do that. Now, in the calculations I'm going to show you, all of the ions are given their crystal radii. We do not adjust any of them to make better fits. Period. The diameter of the channel is set at 6 angstroms and is not changed unless we are studying the effective diameter. And we are going to try to fit large amounts of data with this very reduced model. So the model might be foolish or ridiculous, but it is specific and it is not fooled with or adjusted. Carol,
you... Diameters for lysines and...
We just picked something reasonable for what we thought was reasonable for ammonia. And none of these have been optimized, by the way. A completely legitimate criticism is if that were changed to 2.5, what would happen? We don't know yet. These calculations take a long time. We simply haven't investigated that. So these are viewed as some sort of ad hoc representation. And by the way, also, Carol, we don't believe that the parameters in this model mean what they say. We do not think that the diameter corresponds to the crystal, to the diameter of the protein, of the pore. We don't know what it means. These are effective parameters. Those of you who deal with transistors are used to effective parameters. We can talk about that. What's crucial is we don't fool with them. They're set. Just, I don't want to be too defensive here. If you had a crystal structure of a protein, you don't know how to define the diameter either, because you don't know what physical property of the protein mass corresponds to the important variable, okay? So I don't mean it critically, I just mean it's a hard problem. Yeah. So now here's the result of the Monte Carlo simulation. This is just the result of a simulation. It's a calcium channel, period. That is to say, if we put in 100 millimolar sodium chloride with the system I showed you of various concentrations, we get a calcium channel. These points down here take about 3 or 4 days of CPU time, so they're hard to analyze, but they're absolutely reproducible. I'll explain to you why later, but I'm trying to show you that those are the results. Now, and notice that we're doing this over many concentrations without adjusting any parameters. Now, we can make a mutation because an old friend of mine, Stefan Heinemann, showed about 20 years ago that if you take the charges of the side groups and you change them from DEEA, you get rid of an aspartate and you put in a lysine, you get a sodium channel. Now, look at the axes. The sodium channel has properties totally different from the calcium channel. Its occupancy is totally different. There's no saturation, et cetera, et cetera. It's qualitatively in a different universe. We make that mutation, and that's the result. No parameters adjusted of any kind. Authors totally bewildered and surprised and amazed and didn't believe that this could happen. Because if we didn't have the dielectric boundary force, we wouldn't get this. We had tried this in 27 other papers, okay? When we added the dielectric boundary force, which is a small energy, not tiny, 1/3, 1/4, all of a sudden the entire qualitative properties of the system changed. the dielectric boundary force does not dominate the problem. But when it's in there, you get qualitatively different properties. Engineers, when you build systems, you balance forces. You try to balance things to make it come out the way you want. You're usually not able to have one force dominate. That's our interpretation of these results. But the fact is, that's what you get.
How do you define occupancy there?
Sorry?
How do you define occupancy?
The integral of the number over a certain region.
So in the right channel, so most of the time you have nothing in.
Exactly. Exactly. But you still have plenty of current. That's also a great surprise. There's lots of evidence that that might be true. For example, well, I'll just leave it that. This channel does not show what is called single file behavior. Okay. Most people believe channels always have collision. Okay. Bob Rakowski spent 17 years doing the tracer experiments on the sodium channel. It does not show single file within 1%. Okay. That is only 500 times more accurate than Hodgkin's original measurements on the K channel. And the reason is that very low occupancy channels, there aren't two ions in there at one time to collide. Okay. So yes, you're absolutely right. This is quite different from traditional views. It's very low occupancy. It does show an AMFE and things like that, which we'll talk about. I don't think I'll have time, but that's in all the papers. So we've done 28 papers on the calcium channel. So now I'm going to talk about the sodium channel. Just to reiterate, what we did was to create this sequence of charges and to see what they did. Now, what's striking in this sodium channel is that we have charge selectivity. I guess it's striking, but it's not a surprise. That is, if the dielectric constant of the protein is 10, what we have is a great deal of sodium-calcium selectivity, 25 times, which is about what's found experimentally. Interestingly, if the dielectric constant of the protein is set to 80, there isn't any such selectivity. Okay? Again, a complete surprise. Notice selectivity depends on the dielectric constant. Now, what about size selectivity? How do you get sodium versus potassium selectivity? Well, here's what we found. We found a huge sodium versus potassium selectivity. The 40 is actually larger than is found experimentally. Okay? It's actually larger. So this model shows a great deal of selectivity for sodium versus potassium. And notice that that selectivity does not depend on the dielectric constant, but it depends on the existence of the dielectric boundary force. If you take the force out, this phenomenon collapses. But it's insensitive to the dielectric constant. When Dejo first showed me this point, two calculations superimposing on each other, I, of course, responded the way anybody with gray hair and senior type person, been stupid enough to be chairman 32 years, would respond when talking to a close friend. I said, Dejo, don't show me the same damn data twice. So Dejo, being the kind of scientist he is, walked out and redid the calculation. Okay, of course, the numbers weren't actually equal, but he was going to show the boss. He just redid it. And these points do coincide. Now, why do I say that? Every one of those simulations is totally different. When you change the dielectric constant by a factor of 8, all of the forces are different. It's extraordinarily difficult to change things by a factor of 8 and have points fall on top of each other, unless AMD designed it to work like that. You see, if you are thinking about this as a biologist, you're saying, I'm looking for control variables. Because we know that those exist in biology. Stephen Jay Gould wrote umpteen essays about control variables on the macroscopic scale. This looks very much as if diameter is the control variable for size selectivity, and dielectric constant is the control variable for charge selectivity. Okay? That's a working hypothesis. It may be wrong, but it suggests experiments, and frankly, it's the way you would engineer it. Now, where does this selectivity between sodium and potassium come from? Well, we were highly amused at this slide. When we found the sodium-potassium selectivity, of course, Wolfgang Nauner and I, for a long time, simply didn't believe it. And then after a month or two, we said, well, we better have some explanation. So we look for binding sites, because everybody knows that enzymes and proteins all depend on binding sites. Well, in our model, we have binding sites. They are outputs of the balances of forces. We do not have any chemical energy. There's no quantum mechanics. There are no pi electron orbitals. But ions do pile up in some special places. It's called physics. In physics, binding and things like this are outputs, not assumed. In biology, you assume. You just stick in infinite energies and you pretend that you are, I better not say anything more about our president. Anyway, there are binding sites. The binding sites are variable. They are in different locations depending on different conditions. That immediately falsifies traditional biochemical models that put binding sites of one height in one place. But even worse, the binding sites are not selective. The selectivity in this channel comes from a depletion zone. Well, the transistor people say, sure, of course, we control everything by depletion zones. The mathematicians say, of course, the sensitive variables are in the boundary layers, right, Bob? So you want to get control, you go to the boundary layer. Well, unfortunately, the guys who had first proposed depletion zones in proteins, namely myself, had forgotten we proposed it. And we're very surprised when we saw this graph. Okay? And then one of my students reminded me that 20 years ago I had proposed this. I'm telling you the truth, students. None of us know what we're doing. It's not just you. In fact, when I first met Mark, I proposed about depletion zones, I think because he explained it to me for the first time and I had forgotten I had proposed it. Now, we have binding sites. They are there, but they are unimportant. Now we come back to look at this psi selectivity, again reminding you that it depends on diameter and not dielectric constant. However, the occupancy, not the selectivity, the number of ions in the channel, in other words, presumably its conductance, depends on the dielectric constant. It looks exactly as if we have orthogonal variables. Dielectric constant sets conductance, diameter sets selectivity. Now, do you see how easy it is for the genome to control dielectric constant? It just has to change some of the residues. Diameter is harder. Okay? So we have not been able to build a sodium channel yet because we don't know how to make a channel small enough. This is a protein design problem. Somebody here may figure it out, but we don't know how to do that. In fact, I just had a long exchange of emails this morning with Tillman Shermer and Ryman about how to do it. And they basically said all my ideas were stupid. So. And they didn't have any ideas either, but Tillman said he'd think about it, which means we'll probably have an answer. Okay, so I just want to point out that selectivity in our model is extremely specific. It is specific both chemically and mathematically. Chemically, it tells one ion from another, and mathematically, it comes from an exact calculation, which, by the way, can be done either with Monte Carlo simulation or density functional many different ways, and that's what the 27 papers are about. And Jean-Pierre has done it, and Doug Henderson have done it. So it's been done by all sorts of groups. How does it come about? How do we get the selectivity? Well, it's really extremely simple. Imagine for the minute that we have three glutamates in this space. Or let's, for the minute, make it four. It comes out a little easier. We have four glutamates in this space. If we have sodium around, how many sodiums do we have? Four. By electrical neutrality, you have to have almost the same number. Or if you want, you can go to X-ray, look at other proteins, and you'll see, lo and behold, sometimes you can resolve the counterions. But I hope you all understand that if there weren't the same number of counterions as ions, the voltage in there would be a few volts, and literally, if you get more than 150 millivolts across a membrane, it explodes. It literally explodes, experimentally and in calculations. So we know that we have to crowd in this tremendous number. It's about 25 molar. But if we have calcium, it's much easier. Calcium has two charges, so we only need half as many. So the selectivity comes from simply the trouble in crowding in the sodiums. That's sodium-calcium selectivity. I don't have such a good picture for you for the sodium-potassium selectivity. We do not understand it. We know it comes from the depletion zone, but we have not yet broken that into pieces. Okay, we don't know how the forces balance up. So after all this, if you walked out of here, if I've done a good job as a salesman, I was born a used car salesman. Can't help it. Then you say, oh, gosh, what a great story. But then somewhere an hour or two later, reality would catch up and you would say, what a crock of bad stuff. Because this guy told me all this and he didn't tell me what the protein did. After all, the protein is the key to everything. So in our model, to use the math language, the protein determines certain measures of structure, like volume and dielectric coefficient, and these are crucially important, like your effective parameters in your drift diffusion equations. They determine everything. But the rest of the protein is not involved. That is the properties of the model. It may not be the properties of the protein, but it's a very specific suggestion, and it fits a lot of data. And I don't want to be arrogant, but the kind of selectivity data I've shown you has never been fit by any model whatsoever. No matter how many adjustable parameters, people tried models of up to 300 or 400 parameters. They have actually been published, amazingly. Okay? And they could not deal with two solutions, let alone 20 or 30. So that doesn't mean we're right, but what it means is that our effective parameters are probably enough to capture the main physics. Okay? The precise arrangement of atoms is not involved. What is crucially important is the volume of the pore, the dielectric coefficient, and the permanent charge. One of the interesting consequences of this model is that there are huge mechanical forces on the atoms. Those of you who are familiar with the old Donnan equilibrium will know that, and any of you who are biochemists and use ion-selective columns will know that water rises in them. Okay? There are huge mechanical forces. So we propose that these mechanical forces are the driving force for conformation changes. I've always been terrified for as long as I've known about conformation changes, which is about 1959, as to what drove them. Why did they happen? I had no problems with protein change of structure, but there had to be forces. Well, it turns out that you can't build a protein without enormous mechanical forces. Now, those of you who are disgusted by the vagueness of my comments are correct. Go and do it for me. Okay? Those comments have to be converted into specific models. Our statement about these forces is equivalent to where we were about permeation 25 years ago. We had some idea of what the forces were, but we haven't made a model yet. In our case, we think that selectivity depends on these very simple properties, and orbital delocalization chemical binding is not involved, at least for these proteins. There are many other channel types, and we certainly believe, Carol, that other proteins work differently, okay? However, and this is an important logical point which people may disagree with, but I want to make it clearly. We believe that if a reduced model gets an enormous data set correct, without fooling around, then higher resolution models must be calibrated against the reduced model. That means if you do MD of this system, you have to show that for four spheres of this size, you get the same answer we get. Just to be sure that we're on the same playing field. Okay? Otherwise, your model cannot account for this data. And so making a higher resolution model could actually make things worse if it was uncalibrated. This does not mean we're opposed to high-resolution models. We're doing everything we can and wasting enormous amount of effort to do that without any success. Okay? We are still doing that, and we are going to continue. But they have to be calibrated against what we already know. Whoops. And I want to point out that this kind of approach has been used, as I say, by other people. Now, finally, I don't have time to really talk about this ryanodine receptor, but I just want to point out that Dirk's calculations give results identical to Monte Carlo. These are fits without any adjustable parameters, none. And for those of you, because some of you know a bit about channels, there's an effect called the anomalous mole fraction effect, which has been viewed as something impossible for this class of models to get. So Dirk predicted an anomalous mole fraction effect in sodium-cesium solutions. Gerhard Meisner said that was ridiculous. By the way, Gerhard's a wonderful guy. He enjoys teasing me and has for 25 years. He said, it's ridiculous. I'll make a bet. Now, he's a good Austrian, or maybe from Munich. Excuse me, I'm not quite sure. He doesn't make bets. He says, I'll bet you a steak dinner, and he chose the cheapest restaurant in Chapel Hill. And then he disappeared. And so I phoned him about 2 weeks later, and Gerard said, don't bother me. I need some more results. So he did, what is this, 70 experiments or something, but 62 experiments. That's a lot. Okay? These are hard experiments. He did 62 measurements before he agreed that there was a minimum here. This is the predicted minimum from Dirk's calculations with no adjustable parameters made before the measurement. Okay? So the AMFE does not imply single filing. Our model is able to give AMFE. And Dirk has several papers on this, if you are interested. And he's actually able since then to predict AMFEs in many conditions. And these are the experiments. All the predictions were made without any adjustable parameters. And they were made before the experiments. So I won't go on. What I just want to say then is perhaps I've convinced you that one can talk about an important biological system, ion channels, in the same language one talks about physical systems, that one can take the same approach to them. And if you get things wrong enough for long enough, that is our 28 papers, and you eventually just keep adding pieces. By the way, I didn't tell you the reason we added the dielectric boundary force. Does anyone want to know why we added it? Did we think it was important? No. Did we think it was worth adding? No. But all of our colleagues, Benoit, et cetera, beating the hell out of us, well, we should put this in and put that in. So we figured we had to do each one. We added it and it changed everything. Because in our view, what we have stumbled upon without knowing what we were doing is the fact that for this class of channels, biology gets what it wants by dielectric and diameter, and we seem to be calculating them more or less correctly. At least that's our hope. Thank you very much.
Let's take one or two questions. I apologize, I have to duck out in just a minute, but I wanted to ask a quick one if I could. What happened to the bubbles and the turning the channels on and off? I kind of lost that.
That's just a separate subject.
But I mean, these channels.
Oh, I'm sorry. All the
transport, but it doesn't tell you about turning on.
Exactly. I'm sorry. I left out something very, very serious. I apologize. All of the permeation data is just on the amplitude, which is measured experimentally.
When they're on, this is what happens.
So exactly. But those of you from probability, this is an entire extremely conditioned set. It's not the same set of all proteins. We are studying only channels which can open and are open. Okay? So we know nothing about the opening process. And that's a separate subject which I could only guess at, as you saw before. Well, a little more than guess. Riemann saw xenon. Okay? So we are with gating where we were with permeation 20 years ago. We just have an idea. And it will surely, by the way, not be completely right, but maybe help us. Yes?
Structure of the protein can play a role?
Very, very much so. First of all,
so it's important.
It's extremely important. Let me give you an analogy which unfortunately doesn't carry a lot of weight with younger people. What is the hardest thing to build in an automobile engine? Does anyone know?
Because you told me earlier today.
It's the engine block. Historically, the hardest thing to build was the cast iron block. Any of you who abuse an engine know that the first thing that goes wrong is a warp of the block, and then you're finished. So is the engine block important or not? Well, it's extremely boring. It's so important, however, that no human beings are allowed in the factories that make them. Literally. They're not allowed inside. They only can control the computers because the humans wreck it. They have to be absolutely precise. So the engine block is fantastically important because it keeps everything in the right place. In our model, the sensitivity to volume and dielectric coefficient is extreme. I didn't really say it that way, but if you remember, there were lots of curves going like this. Those were structural variables. So what we're arguing is for this function of these proteins, those are the only things the protein do, but they're very important. Now, how that maps into the details of the atomic structure, we don't know. And anybody who says they know should be chastised. Well, we think the right way to go about this is to take higher resolution methods, both in mathematics and modeling and simulation and structure, and try to find out what do we mean by volume? What do we mean by dielectric coefficient? And to use those as the reduced variables which are the target rather than trying to calculate everything. Now, that may be right or wrong, but it's a way, it's a good way to plan research and to, I hope, make some progress.
Okay, I know several people will have to get off the class, but let's take one more question.
So your reduced model, you had various balls.
Right.
If you reposition those balls, yeah.
Brilliant question.
Keep the same number and charge and all.
First of all, I didn't say this again. Apologies. Every ball is in its free energy minimum. So they are where they are by the Monte Carlo simulation. None were adjusted at all. We are now in the process of doing that with extremely exciting results, and that's all I should say at this stage. We're doing exactly what you've said, which is positioning them in different places with different free energy penalties and springs, and we have reproducible, reliable, extremely exciting results, but I can't summarize them yet. I'm not trying to be discreet, but I want to understand them. And like Gerhard said this morning, you've had results since Christmas you couldn't understand. It's characteristic of a simulation that you know that. You have results. So until we understand them, I don't want to talk about them. But the effects you're talking about are very real and very important.
Okay. So if there are more questions, Bob will be here. I encourage you to talk with him.
And I'm only in Chicago. I'm on email. Mark will tell you I answer at all times of day and night, right? And secondly, you might have noticed I like to talk. So if some of you want to pursue this, you're welcome to come up to Chicago, Sin City. Or invite me down, and I'm glad to chat with you about it, because one of my greatest goals is to interest younger people in solving some of the problems we don't know how to do.
Thanks again.